Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Mark Moreau. Mark is Senior Fellow and Policy Director of the Metro Policy Programme at Brookings Institution. And the focus of today's podcast is a recent report that Mark co-authored with Robert Atkinson and Jacob Whitton entitled The Case for Growth Centres, How to Spread Tech Innovation Across America. Mark, welcome to City Talks.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, and we're big admirers of you all, so thanks so much.
Well, it's likewise. I think the work that Brookings and you particularly do is brilliant. It's an inspiration for us to see what you're up to and then see if we can at least copy it if even if we can't better it. So I think we're in for a good conversation.
But we thought we were copying you. So
maybe if we assume that we're copying each other, then yeah. Maybe we're making some progress. And the report, I think, is just, I mean, it's incredibly timely. Obviously, it's timely from your point of view in America and this, you know, the trends you see in the US, but obviously highly relevant to the debates that are going on in the UK, in the shape of the economy and how we might want to change it. And indeed, I think very relevant to conversations about the nature and shape of the European economy as well and what needs to happen on that. So as a way of kicking us off, Mark, do you want to just say a little bit about, because you start the report very explicitly in this sort of notion of two Americas, and in the sense that, you know, the emergence of these two Americas over the last, 2 to 3 decades. Just say a little bit about what, you know, from your understanding, what your perspective is on the two Americas.
Yeah, so, you know, our center, somewhat like yours, wants to be a national observer of trends as they affect, hundreds of places. And so it's a central matter to us of, the distribution of growth. And we have been struck increasingly, in the last 10 to 15 years at the sort of breakdown of the old idea in the United States, for sure, of convergence. The idea that places grew together, that there was something about the economy that was self-regulating, and that naturally the places that were left behind or had started poorer would catch up, with the great story of the catch-up of our South, the new South, in the last century, closed many of the economic deficits it was facing. So there was this sort of natural self-regulation that was actually, I think, taken for granted in this country, but gave a lot of license to people to believe that things would take care of themselves. And so I think it was also a license for inaction or non-intervention. What has become clear is that not only has convergence broken down in the years certainly after 1980, but we're now in a period of divergence in which a short list of fortunate places with high education levels, not coincidentally high levels of digital dexterity, and then high pay and high centrality in the global digital economy have begun to pull away. So it's not just a matter that we're not converging, we're pulling away from each other. So rather than growing together, the nations, regions, metro areas, and towns have been growing apart. This is extreme in this country and has prompted, a line of work that I've been focused on the last few years and certainly since the election of President Trump. But it also turns out to be a global dynamic in many respects. And we have learned a lot from observing the UK's own study of itself. So maybe I'll leave it at that. But it's sort of this transition from divergence to from convergence to divergence, and then with a vengeance in this decade.
In this decade. And so we'll get on to some of the underlying reasons for that divergence in a second. But just lay out geographically, when you look at very crudely over the last 20 or 30 years, you know, geographically, what parts of the US have essentially been the winners, you know, those that have increasingly done well? And what are the parts of the US that have increasingly done less well or actually declined?
Right. In the UK, obviously, this is a matter of the South versus the North. Mm. Here, it's especially the coast versus the non-coastal sort of heartland. So, you know, the winners, and we can underscore how significantly they are winning, are places like Boston on the East Coast, and then four big metros on the Pacific coast: Seattle, the two Bay Area metropolitan areas, San Jose and San Francisco, and then San Diego. And we could add a few more to this, but these are places that had high education levels in 1980, high adoption and rapid adoption of digital technologies, and an attractive standard of living and climate. So those places have pulled away, and maybe we could say at maximum there are 20 super winners, mostly coastal, but some inland, maybe like a college town like Madison, Wisconsin. So you have, let's say 10 places like that on the coast. Maybe throw in New York. On some measures, Washington, D.C., big, highly educated, technology centers in general. And those are growing at a fast rate in seeing their income levels accelerate. And they frequently are the home to global platforms in the tech economy, which I think is also not coincidental.
Because that's an interesting one. You were alluding to it there, because as you know, it'd be interesting to get your thought on, of those, the 20 superstars or the very much the winners, the sort of size and scale of them. Because, you touched on places like Seattle and Boston and obviously San Francisco, but also, maybe New York. Because as you know, part of the story in the UK, at least, is our southern urban areas doing particularly well, obviously dominated by, London at, 10 million population, depending on how you kind of draw the boundary. But then a bunch of smaller places, 200, 300,000 sort of localities dotted around London doing particularly well, in part borrowing from, from the scale and the vibrancy of London. But actually, when you then move through the Midlands and the North, it's actually some of our bigger urban areas, our greater Manchester's, greater Birmingham's, greater Leeds, that are still behind the curve in terms of capturing the benefits of the modern economy. And I just wonder, is there a size issue in terms of those winners for you, or not really?
Size seems to have some correlation, and we do break out size, and that it is predictive in the United States. But there are also other factors. Clearly, education level is highly predictive. And therefore, a whole swath of university cities look quite good in the United States. So I think but across all of this, the important thing is that if you rank places by performance on particular measures, such as employment or annual wages, you get these tiered rank orders with very different performance levels, with the leaders on, you know, key metrics like education level, presence of PhDs, various science measures are clearly pulling away. So that seems stronger, but this does seem associated with largeness as a first order impact.
Okay, so going to this issue around, you know, the increasing importance of innovation to the US economy, obviously to the UK economy, in fact, to any OECD country economy, you know, and you look at sort of advanced industries as you label them, but that, you know, that's becoming an increasing significant driver of prosperity and productivity. So just say a little bit more about why that is. And then I suppose the follow on is, the innovation economy is even more spiky than the economy in general, for the reasons that I'd like to get your perspective on as well. So just say something about the increasing importance of innovation, and then how geography underpins how the innovation economy is distributed across the US.
Right. Perfect. And you're prompting exactly the right issues. When we talk about this, we have to think, what changed around 1980, I think? Because throughout most of this last century, divergence was in control in the United States, for instance. And I think we come down to a very big change in the underlying or the overall economic order. This transition from a traditional economy dependent on cost-effective access to physical resources, land, climate, transportation, that was all about low factor costs, right? Well, that has shifted and become secondary as an innovation, digitally driven economy driven by pervasive tech that revolves around IP, concentrations of talent, and intense clustering or agglomeration came to the fore. So we think that transition that we all sort of know about was actually an epical change that is now greatly altering the physical expression of the economy. And so I think the cost factors are now secondary to innovation measures, to IP, to talent. And we're in a world where economic activity isn't distributed to follow infrastructure or the geography of lakes and rivers and ports. And it's not about natural resources. It's about, human resources, creativity, innovation, talent. And it has this different – it's not about diffusion or networks across the country. It's about lock-in and winner-take-all dynamics in a short list of places that allow the near infinite returns to additional marginal investments in tech. So we think that's the fundamental thing to look at, or certainly part of it.
And we'll get on. Get you just to give some stats in a minute, which just show the capture almost of in these places of the innovation economy. But you're interested in your thought, looking over that period, Mark. I mean, what's your sense that how important was policy at the federal level or at the state or at the local level in bringing these changes about? Because this is one of the debates, that is ongoing in the UK, is that, the reemergence of urban areas as we see them is often characterized as being essentially policy driven, and the sort of economic forces that are encouraging co-location, both of people and of firms, the increasing significance of knowledge exchange and knowledge spillovers, which are essentially operating through market orientated mechanisms, get very much downplayed. And I'm always curious when I get people from different contexts as to, you know, where they see the nature of the debate. But so how important, how significant has policy been in driving the you know, the characteristics you just laid out?
I would say policy type investments, and really policy indirectly, was determinative and massively so, but it wasn't recognized. So there's no doubt. I mean, the story of Silicon Valley, the story really of Boston's tech concentration is well known, and it's not controversial to note that it was, you know, from the very beginning, you know, essentially industrial policy by a different name. You know, it was essentially our defense investments in electronics that led to this whole trend. Now, of course, in each place there were significant research university complexes that were also built both for defense reasons and other reasons throughout the last century. So, you know, it's policy, yet without the name policy. And I think, you know, and I do think that, and that has, I think, hobbled American discussions, because, you know, I think it's a less challenging view to just assume that this has just happened through, you know, the, you know, accidental arrivals of Bill Gates in Seattle, or you know, and such, and we think it's quite different. So we think policy has been important. It hasn't been called that, and it will be very important going forward. And we can talk about that.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that. Just give us a couple of headline stats, if you can, just to paint the picture of, you know, this incredible sort of spikiness of the, you know, the innovation economy. You've got a great one around, you know, innovation jobs in the top 20 metro areas. But just give us a couple, if you've got them to hand, on just to give us a sense of the scale.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, we've discussed this is broadly a matter of the innovation economy and the digital economy. We broke out for our recent research a swath of particularly high R&D and STEM industries. We've looked at what we call advanced industries, which have high STEM and high R&D levels. We looked at an innovation sector of 13 industries with very, very high investment levels of those kinds, and arrived with, you know, a pretty disturbing figure that, you know, has captured some attention in this country. We found that 90% of employment growth in that swath of 13 innovation industries over the last decade plus occurred in just those five metros: Boston, San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, and San Diego. Wow. So that's 90% of the nation's innovation sector growth, as defined by this admittedly, you know, narrow and demanding measure, between the years 2005 to 2017, occurred in those five cities.
And so I think that's an important point, isn't it? Yeah.
Only 10% of that growth was distributed broadly over the country. So you could see why that's one dimension of a kind of, you know, growing backlash against the tech project in this country, which is another challenge for that this raises.
And it reinforces, you know, the point you were making earlier on, which is, you know, typically we would expect, or at least be able to suggest, that we would begin to see catch-up growth in places that are behind the curve. But because of the dynamics that you've laid out around agglomeration, concentration, interaction, actually it's those places that are already ahead are better able to maintain their leadership and actually take it even further.
Yeah, it's another sort of – we've talked about how we had industrial policy that wasn't called industrial policy. We also have concentration that isn't realized as concentration. You know, one of the great hopes – and I harbor it and support it and admire the so-called sort of rise of the rest movement in this country, the hope for – you know, heartland uplift, particularly through tech. Well, there are more tech jobs sprouting up in places numerically, but if you look at shifts, shares, and shares of the overall industry, we're actually seeing greater concentration still. Mm-hmm. At some point, one would think by classical, you know, economic theory that that would end, but and diffusion would occur, but I think there are arguments that one can argue that innovation dynamics might not lead to that outcome of diffusion.
Yeah, I think that's one of the other many things. But one of the things I enjoyed about the report is that you're preempting, some sort of the pushback or the reaction to the, to your findings and then your proposals. In a sense, you know, we hear this a lot, don't we? Particularly from less spatially minded economists is, well, it's okay. You know, we're in a sort of, you know, a spatial equilibrium situation. And the market will adjust over time, over what time we don't know, but over time, and everything will kind of work out, fine on the one hand. And obviously the other point would be, well, you know, don't worry, the regional variation we see, you know, at the aggregate level, you know, if it's welfare maximizing. So, you know, be careful about redistribution, and the effect it has on an overall growth. So just say a little bit about why you think both of those things are slightly overstated as mechanisms to deal with the problem as we see it.
Well, we do think that the convergence economy broke down towards the end of the last century. Something went wrong with it, and it's manifestly not expressing itself. So the question is that a temporary problem, or is there a deep set reason that something has changed? And I think we're raising the possibility that it is the latter possibility, that the fundamental activity of the economy is now about innovation, and that has different geographical and equilibrium effects. The equilibrium effects are more of lock-in, agglomeration, lock-in, and maybe cumulative causation is the phrase that, UK scholars in the last century coined. And if that is true, we might wait a very long time for some kind of equilibrium return and spread of activity out into the country. We think that might not happen. And if we think that, then I think we are confronted with needing to think about policies that are much more than essentially just waiting.
Yeah. And I think the other point you make in the book, which is, we do see activity, leaving, for example, some of the superstar cities. It's just that they're not going to necessarily other parts of the US, second or third tier localities. They're actually going to other parts of the world. And you've got a fantastic set of stats in regards to cost of living. The one I love is, I don't know how you kind of work this out, but it's fascinating nevertheless. Shanghai is 35% cheaper than Boston, but Detroit is 34%. And yet when we see stuff leaving Boston, it's probably going to Shanghai rather than it's going to Detroit, which is telling us something about it's not cost that that is really driving the location decisions of the innovation economy.
Well, this economy is all about concentrations and pools of talent and agglomeration. And I think in the United States that we have not cultivated enough alternative hubs to retain, onshore that any kind of diffusion that does occur. We certainly have you know, challenging enough conditions in the Bay Area in terms of a housing crisis and traffic crisis and homeless crisis to motivate more onshoring into the heartland, but it hasn't really occurred in large numbers. So I think that's actually more evidence that those other alternative centers have kind of been undernourished over 50 years and maybe aren't truly, you know, viable alternatives.
And that's a perfect segue into the sort of the big idea, as it were, in the report, which is about trying to counter this sort of regional divergence through through growth centres. And you know, and in some regards, you kind of allude to it. It's a renewal and an improvement on previous theories around growth poles, etc. So just outline a little bit around what's the overarching theory or of approach that you and your co-authors are advocating.
Well, you know, there has been an idea around, you know, really since the 1970s and 80s of, you know, a policy focus on the development of a short list of places with an explicit idea of, you know, altering a national geographical distribution. And we think that while that idea was, you know, not that successful in the way it was particularly implemented in some places, we think it actually may have a use now and may suit quite well to the conditions and challenge we face, which we think we need essentially to use something of a brute force model to, you know, shove more places onto a high growth trajectory based on especially university-based R&D, high quality placemaking, and, you know, skills development with a particular focus on economic and social inclusion. And we think that is the sweet spot. We think we know more than we think we do about what can work. But we haven't tried anything at scale, and so we propose for now a selective experiment of really shoving a huge amount of R&D into 8 to 10 potential growth centers selected through a national competition. Places will need to have, you know, a major research university. They'll need to have some toehold in plausible starting point in some of these issues some of these technologies. And they need to have a reform-minded, you know, hard-edged and really cogent plan for getting to the next level. But we think we're going to need to, you know, conduct some major experiments to somewhat force some of the convergence or, you know, spread to new places that isn't necessarily occurring.
Yeah, so just say a little bit more around, because I think that's a really interesting idea, just say a little bit more around the criteria that you began to think about, A, that was important to, you know, to these, if these are kind of innovative. So one of the major additions is that you would say, you know, a much more focus on, you know, innovation aspects of the economy and of growth rather than just generalized growth poles, which I think is probably what the previous policies tended to be in. But just say a little bit more around, you know, the tweaks that you would make. And then I suppose some of the criteria that you would at least begin to think about using to identify where the potential candidates could be. Because in a sense, probably the US is exactly the same as the UK. You know, everywhere claims that they could be the next Silicon Valley in the UK's context, or, you know, the next Cambridge, or, you know, whatever it might be. And, you know, a bit of realism, which actually recognizes where places are, on current strengths, but actually also the potential is really important. So just say a little bit more around, you know, some of those issues or criteria that you had in your mind.
Well, yes, and we're talking about, you know, the award of a major package of federal innovation inputs, placemaking inputs, training and inclusion inputs to select places. We don't think that there would be 50 of these places. We think, you know, 8 to 10, mm-hmm. you know, places would be a good starting point for a challenge based on things like, you know, presence of a major university, some presence in relevant research activities tied to some kind of local economic story. We think, as an experiment, demonstrate not what the final candidates would be, but we use a number of metrics to arrive at something like 30 to 35 places that we think are out there that have some of these kinds of attributes, university STEM R&D load, patents, BA share, STEM doctoral degrees, innovation sector job share. Mm-hmm. You can go through an array of kind of standard metrics of reality in an innovation economy. We do that as an exercise. In part to show, you know, skeptics and lawmakers that, in fact, there are 35 pretty promising places out there, and maybe more. I think that is news to some. I mean, I think skeptics actually think that the market is, you know, rewarding what exists and that everything else is, you know, unpromising, and we don't think that's true. But we do think that it will require this kind of transformative investment agenda targeted in a short list of places to, as I was saying, kind of shove, you know, 8 to 10 promising places onto a sort of promising agenda, trajectory.
And the sorts of places, you know, geographically, these are, from looking at the report, these are not places that are on or near to some of the coastal areas and some of the superstar places that you've already identified. And actually, you know, it does include some places that will, you know, are very familiar to people in terms of places like Pittsburgh or Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Nashville. But a lot of them in that sort of that the industrial heartland, I suppose, of the, you know, of the U.S.
Yeah, it's an interesting list. First, it many of the places have an industrial history that, and I think that's in part because that often supported and occurred alongside the development of a major university presence. So you mm-hmm. think of places, you know, like Rochester, New York, or Albany, New York, and the upstate areas, that while they were, you know, hubs of world manufacturing, were also funding and creating, you know, enviable world-class complexes of universities. Certainly, you know, Pittsburgh is preeminently that. But there are also, you know, places, in the Midwest, Kansas City. People don't think about it that much, but it has a lot of assets. Des Moines, Knoxville, Tennessee, Cleveland, all of these places have, you know, attributes that with proper investment and scaling, you know, really may have real possibilities. We are trying to not be starry-eyed about this. We do think this is an experiment. We suspect it won't work in one or two of the places that are selected, but we think we've got to try because we don't think we're going to get new naturally occurring places. And these places do have a particular presence. One last thing, we explicitly do have a 100-plus mile screen. If a place is within 100 miles of another place, it's likely somewhat subsidiary to that place, and we think, you know, we aren't going to get the geographical reach that we need. So a place like Philadelphia, which is a very increasingly vibrant place, is not included because it's 100 miles from New York, less than 100 miles from New York. But, you know, in other cases, we have, you know, so we're able to populate the map of the interior of the United States fairly helpfully, I think.
And what's the I know you, it's the degree, you know, somewhat, well, a degree of, you know, arbitrariness in there. But in terms of, you know, the kind of scale of investment that you're advocating that the federal government, you know, undertakes in terms of, you know, monetary resources plus timescale, what kind of numbers are you suggesting and why?
Well, we're looking at a sustained push over 10 years. This can't be, you know, a sort of one-off. And, you know, we're talking something like $6 billion per metro area for each decade. You know, in a total, you know, something like $100 billion, what we're calling innovation surge. So it's real money, yet it's not, in the scheme of things, massive. We've been criticized for being way too big, and we've been criticized for being way too small, you know? And I'm not sure which is the right answer. You know, probably we need to do, you know, more. But we do think that this is a serious and transformative investment that would be extended over a decade.
And what's how do you envisage the sort of relationship or the interaction between the metro itself and then, you know, the federal government on the other hand? Because this is, again, in the UK, that's always a kind of conversation which is about, as you know, we are heavily centralized as an economy and as a, you know, a kind of policy making country. Most decisions of significance taken by at the national government rather than the local government. Attempts to try and recalibrate the relationship to a degree, but finding the balance between the sort of top down, bottom up perspective and approach is always, you know, is always difficult and challenging. It's interesting in, you know, your kind of thoughts on how that might play out.
Yeah, well, this is an area where I think we learn from you and in some ways think we need a little more centralization, a little more top-down, because we've abdicated that almost entirely in this space in some ways. Whereas maybe you need a little more of our bottom-up genius, I guess. We think about this in this way. We actually don't see ours, though, as an entirely top-down activity. The hope for regeneration through technology in the heartland in the United States has been almost entirely dominated by, though, a bottom-up sensibility. And we think that's valid and important to preserve. And clearly, states as intermediary layers that are between the bottom and the top are important. So we think our vision is of big federal resources and tough stipulations of quality and, you know, the elements of success, but much local determination. So, you know, we think that's the actual sweet spot in all of these kinds of efforts. So, you know, Each city would need to have an account of, you know, it would develop the technology vision and game plan. It would need to draw the state into its efforts. It would need to develop a degree of matching resources. So we think it would be a hybrid of top-down investment, but with bottom-up programmatic detail. And really, in the end, when you look at how places like Boston and Silicon Valley came to be, when you truly, back out who was doing what, that's largely what it has been, some mix. And we want that to be more explicit here.
Yeah, I think the point you make there, and you've made it earlier, I mean, I think it's very similar in some respects in the UK is actually non-spatial policies and investments through defence, through education, through health have had significant spatial consequences and successes. But actually, that's largely been a sort of secondary or not even a tertiary kind of consideration when you look at what's been, what's been happening over the last 40 to 50 years, never mind the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's again, I guess, that theme that's emerged in our discussion. We do know more than we think and more than we acknowledge. And we don't acknowledge it by the terms given, right?
No.
But this spatial expression is now absolutely unavoidable. It's now dinner table conversation in places like Topeka and Wichita and Birmingham in the United States. And I'm sure even more so in the middle and north of your country.
Yes, no, absolutely. I think it's been remarkable how I use the word every day, loosely, but every day, these issues in relation to the differences between places has become over the last half a decade at least, and Brexit in this country was a lightning rod to further expose some of the differences. I was going to ask you a little bit around, is the federal government listening? Or are national politicians listening? Obviously, you'll be going into a presidential election period relatively shortly. So, I mean, but are national politicians similarly on board with these kind of regional differences and the implications for politics as well as economics?
Well, it's really interesting. First, we have been gratified by significant inquiries and interest, both from Democratic senators, but also several Republicans, including at our, Capitol Hill rollout of this. Senator Moran of Kansas, was very heartfelt, didn't adopt or endorse every aspect, but was very supportive. And we think, and we're seeing some of the candidates talking about these issues now. Elizabeth Warren has talked about the diffusion of R&D and the need for some regional diffusion of R&D. Cory Booker has a cities agenda that talks about hubs of some sort. This is on people's mind. And I think it is a sleeper issue. We'll have to see. I mean, clearly concern about, green eyeshade concerns about the federal budget are at a low point. So there may be a window for consideration of these kinds of ideas. And I think we can't underestimate the fact that we have a spatial emergency underway in this country and yours, and really in many places around the world. There is a deep concern, and I think the policy classes, the economic elites are realizing that even if you don't believe any of this mumbo jumbo about agglomeration effects and differing technology-based economies, we do have substantial political side effects. A new kind of negative externality has really spread and is forcing recognition or at least response to these issues.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the work of Andrés Rodríguez Pozé under a kind of overall banner that he refers to as the kind of revenge of the places left behind. And I've talked to Andrés as part of City Talks. You know, he talks about this, you know, the sort of political externalities associated with dislocation, disenfranchisement, and, you know, disconnection from prosperity as you know, as places understand it. And, you know, I think his work is just really fascinating. The other one I was struck by was I was lucky enough to talk with an interview Jonathan Rodden on his book Why Cities Lose, which is primarily about the US, but actually much more than that, and in just showing the, you know, again, the, and reminding us of the interconnections between politics and the economy, which I think in too many, maybe in more recent past, we've tended to dislocate and disconnect those two things. And I think in some respects, this conversation and the conversations around regional economic performance begins to bring the two back together.
Absolutely. And this was some of what I was saying at the top. You know, we have been actually deeply immersed in, you know, UK discussions such as, you know, work by Ron Martin at Cambridge, Philip McCann's work at Sheffield, and Andres's work. Andre, we had him over here for a, you know, brown bag discussion with our team. We think he's, you know, been early in seeing this. And, you know, and we talk in part of our discussion about the effects, we talk about economic costs, you know, that over concentration is imposing efficiency impact, but it's also leading to the inefficiency of wasted resources, human and other, in the rest of the country. We also see social costs. You know, this is also a justice issue.
Yeah.
You were talking about distance from opportunity for wide swaths of the country. And then finally, you know, political externalities. We think these are very real. And if you wonder how you tie it back to, you know, economic affairs, well, we think this is eroding, you know, the hitherto strong U.S. consensus around, you know, technology-based economic development and even the innovation story is beginning to be viewed as somehow elitist and a pet plaything of someone else, because so much of the country seems so distant from what is happening on the coast. And I think maybe the UK has been early in having to grapple with all of this for really longer in a more extreme form in some ways. But, you know, measures, national measure, cross-national measures, though, now see U.S. concentration and divergence outstripping that in other countries. So, you know, there's been new research on, you know, the effects of the digital economy and, you know, the U.S. divergence is, you know, now outstripping Western European countries.
No, absolutely. And well, we're talking in early January 2020. You know, we have a new government, which at its heart has set itself a goal to level up the country, as you know, in their sort of phrasing, which is essentially, you know, trying to address the variation that we see between, crudely, the kind of southern half, but particularly, you know, the super region around London, and then the rest of the country through the Midlands and the North. They have they've been very explicit on that being a kind of national governmental objective. So we have hope that you know, that they will be engaged in the nature of the debate, and you know, will see fit to allocate significant investment and commitment to, you know, to trying to make this happen over the next 5 to 10 years. And it's good to hear that, you know, you have you know, both at current government, but also, you know, presidential candidates that are similarly interested in this sort of agenda.
Well, maybe that discussion there is an augury of where this country is arriving. You seem to have been a few months ahead of us on the sort of chaos trajectory. So I'm not surprised. And actually, my co-author Rob Atkinson is coming over to do a talk in February, April. You know, we're not unaware of the relevance of the context.
Well, we would definitely like to host him if he's over, and if whenever you're over as well, Mark, we'd definitely like to host you as well. But for now, my guest today has been Mark Moreau. Mark, thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thanks so much for having me. Great discussion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.